Then again, think about this, that the people that decommission them are probably all on Ritalin or some kind of meth
Yeah.
to keep them concentrating, but there's not going to be enough methamphetamines to go around to decommission these missiles, and they're all going to be ADHD nuclear missile decommissioners. That's comforting.
Like, you probably could have bought, if someone had wanted to, I bet you could have gotten Lenin's corpse. It might have cost a pretty penny, but you probably could have gotten Lenin's corpse
Okay,
in
well,
the.
so what corpses do you want to buy in the end game?
That's a good question.
Hey guys, Rafi and Phil back with this month's edition of the Bitter Endgame Draft with Phil Lowe and myself. Today we have three topics. We're going to talk about technical trading and gurus. Do they have any value, or are they just the same as everyone else in an inflationary environment and they make a lot of money because everybody does in an inflationary environment when you're investing in assets and stuff? The second topic was what, Phil?
Oh, how the state can start minting silver again after the crash. You
Right,
want to
right,
start?
right. It's going to be the end game and there's going to be chaos, and all of a sudden we're going to expect the state to mint silver. How is that going to happen if the state doesn't have any silver? Because the state doesn't have any silver. So, what does money look like in the immediate aftermath of the end game? And the third topic is inspired by current events that just happened over the weekend, that the ACIP committee, I don't even know what it stands for, and committee is redundant because the C in the ACIP committee stands for committee. But anyway, they decided to stop recommending hepatitis B vaccine shots for day-old babies because they suddenly came to the realization that they don't have unprotected sex with hookers.
Okay, I'm going.
The ladies' man, huh?
And vaccines are not riskless, especially on day-old babies. So this could be a sea change. And what I wanted to talk about with that is the politicization of health, whereas these questions about who to vaccinate, who not to, shouldn't be political at all, but they are, because politics is really just talking about subjects that the government controls. And if the government controls everything, then everything is ipso facto political, even though it shouldn't be. And the worst political thing is money itself. Once you politicize money, you politicize everything, because then you can inflate and fund everything by the government. So once money becomes politicized, everything by extension becomes politicized to the first degree, and it gets worse as spending increases. But that's what I wanted to say, but we'll go deeper into that later in the show. Phil, you wanted to talk about gurus and technical trading. Is there any value to this stuff?
Okay, yeah. So I just did a video on it, and I had a lot of I had some push. I had a lot of likes, but I had some pushback from people. I really picked the guy out at random. He's a YouTuber by the name of Johnny Bravo, and does a bunch of technical analysis. And you can subscribe to his group, and they all do this. Every single technical trader does this. This is how they get their bread and butter.
Is he
You
the
can
guy who had
subscribe.
that cartoon on the Cartoon Network, Johnny Bravo? Or is
He's
that his.
That there is a cartoon character called Johnny Bravo. This guy looks just like that guy. He has like some really spiked up hair.
Oh, you drive me wild.
I mean, comically spiked up hair. And I pointed that out. I actually probably, so a viewer pointed out to me. So I was like, would you want to trust a guy with this hair to like man to help you manage your money? And then I immediately went to an advertisement with Keith Weiner, and he was like, it's like, good job, Phil. Yeah, you did. So
Right.
if good hair is to be the judge of monetary management, I did not. I failed in that department of successfully guiding people over.
Well, you're
But
a
anyway.
failure. What can I say?
Well, the hair is, I mean, if anyone knows who Johnny Bravo, the hair is a dominant feature of his show. Like it's what, it's very loud. Let me put it that way. Very dominant. It's like pow. Anyway, so the point I was trying to get at was not the technical trading gurus are not running scams, but they are running a hustle. And so what do I mean by that? A scam is something where the product is not being delivered. You know, the product is not being delivered as intended. They are absolutely delivering the product that they say they're delivering. They're teaching people how to technical trade. The problem is that it's probably not very useful. I don't think people are getting the gains they think they are getting. So to explain why, let me backtrack a little bit. People go to where liquidity is. So in 1849 in California, a bunch of liquidity was discovered in the mountains of California. So everybody and their mothers jumped on covered wagons and walked west to go get access to that liquidity. They said, well, that is money. That is literally money at surface level gold or almost surface level gold. You can get at it with a single shovel if you go and get there quickly. But of course, because it's easy access surface level gold, everybody rushed from all over around the world. Now, do you know who really made a lot of money during the gold rush, Ravi?
The people that discovered it first?
No, the people who sold the shovels.
I think we need shovels.
Those guys made absolute killing. They made far more money than on average. You know, of course, there's always a few guys who absolutely strike it rich. You know, they find the mother load of a giant nugget of gold this big, right?
Right. So basically the analogy is the ones that are selling advice on the current gold rush of the market because of inflation are the ones making the most money.
Yeah, the ones they're exactly the ones selling the shovels, right? On average, the guys who got they put a bunch of shovels on a boat from New York and sailed as fast as they possibly could to San Francisco, got off, and then just started hawking shovels to all the people who were rushing over, right?
Chief, you can take this job and you can shovel it.
Take this job and shovel it.
Yeah.
Close enough.
They were the ones who made the real killing. So if you think of the liquidity of the modern system, it's not real. This is fake liquidity being generated by the Federal Reserve. And wherever that fake liquidity is being injected is what gets the bubble. And it just so happens to be the stock market. If they were injecting the liquidity into consumer goods, it would be consumer goods that would be spiking up at prices. But they obviously don't want to do that because that would end their Ponzi scheme way faster. So the stock market goes up, you know, what's the average on the S&P? Is it 5% a year, 10% a year, something like that? It goes up, you know, at some very high level. And so everyone looks
against
like
gold, it goes up zero, but don't say that.
No, I mean, in dollar terms, yeah.
Yeah.
In dollar terms, it goes up, you know, 5-10% a year or something like that. And that's just a generalized broad stock portfolio. Everyone looks like a winner. It's like a casino where everyone wins. The only problem is you can't cash out the chips.
Right, so that's the analogy where we met. That's how you reached out to me on the casino analogy where you can't cash out.
Yeah, you can win as many chips. It's like the Hotel California. You can win all the chips you want. You just can never cash them out. Mm-hmm. So the fake liquidity is drawing all these people into it. Everyone's flooding in, and everyone is, you know, in. One of the effects of inflation is that productive work looks foolish by comparison to just running off to go join the liquidity frenzy, right? So the analogy I use is, you know, imagine you're a plumber and you're, you know, cleaning some lady's toilet and, you know, there's a clog real deep in there and you got to get under the house and you're, you know, doing this and just, you know, shit water's dripping on you and you're, you know, in an uncomfortable position for 8 hours. And
should probably strengthen your immune system, I think.
Yeah. We swam in raw sewage. It strengthened our immune systems. The polio never had a prayer. We were tempered in raw shit.
And you know, you finally get it fixed and, you know, you crawl out from under her space and you're like, that'll be $200, you know? And then you get home and your cousin's like, oh, I just made $10,000, you know, day trading on the stock market. And you're just like, what the hell am I doing here? Like, why am I trying to do this productive work when I could be, you know, just sitting at home, you know, drool as I watch the stock market ticky things. So everyone abandons, and this is a constant sign of high inflationary periods. Happened in hyperinflation in France, happened in the hyperinflation of Weimar. Everyone becomes a stock jobber. Everyone just rushes off to the Wall Street, you know, whatever of their country, and tries to make it big.
That's how it was in the 1920s, in the Roaring Twenties. Everyone was a stock jobber, a bondsman.
Yeah.
You know, you read The Great Gatsby. That was his job.
Yeah, that was my
that and bootlegging, but yeah.
Yeah, my great grandfather, I think I told you, was a stock jobber too. Everyone's a stock jobber. I mean, he was a good one. He made $2 million in the 20s. He lost it all in 29, but
Oh, so he didn't make it at all then.
Yeah. Well, it was a good 10-year run.
Okay. Yeah. Was he also a bootlegger?
It's all about you. No. He was a stock jobber, not a bootlegger.
Oh, well. That would be cool if he was both.
Maybe. Well, I don't know. I didn't hear that part of it. All I know is the stock jobbing. But yeah, in 1928, they had $2 million in 1920s dollars. And by 1929, they had $0 in 1920s dollars.
Right.
Anyway, so everyone's rushing into the liquidity, wherever the liquidity is being generated. So, you know, the plumber puts down his tools and runs off to join the stock market. Now, along the way, these gentlemen show up who say, I'm very good at technically trading the stock market. If you look at a stock market chart, if you look at all the charts of companies and look at bonds and stocks and, you know, the patterns look like they show up. You know, there's the cup and handle pattern, there's the head and shoulders pattern, there's, you know, grinding lines up, grinding lines down, there's candles, you know, there's all kinds of different patterns that show up. And they say, and these technical gurus, and there's a bunch of them, I'm not just singly picking on Johnny Bravo, there's a bunch of them say, we can analyze these patterns and they can be very predictive of the future. And therefore, if you use our services, we will help you get more out of the stock market than if you were just doing this blind. If you understand what's called efficient market hypothesis, that would tend to degrade this claim. An efficient market hypothesis goes that there are so many eyes on the market, there are so many people buying and selling and trading, that you know, there that any one particular gain is going to be quickly overwhelmed by, you know, everyone discovering it roughly the same time. Now, it's true that there are exceptions. Like you and I, we have bet our life savings that the market is incorrectly pricing gold and silver, right? Yeah. I mean, we are wagering that the market is in fact inefficient.
Well, we have as a backing that we don't have to risk our life savings on money itself because we know logically it is money itself, and therefore there is something that we're not risking, but that's a special case.
Yeah, sure. We're using logic to counteract, to say that the market is in fact being inefficient. To just look at pattern analysis, though, is to assume what you are assuming is that the trading desk of JP Morgan can't figure out pattern analysis, right? So JP Morgan's looking at the cup and handle. Oh, I don't know what that means, right? I can't figure this out. But you and your little band of, your little band of pirates can in fact see this cup and handle, and that JP Morgan is, you know, they're too stupid. Maybe you're right. I'm very skeptical. I'm skeptical that you're right, that you're in fact outperforming JP Morgan is the point, or the trading, that you're going to outperform these guys, just from pattern recognition, you know, pattern analysis. There, if you have a healthy, logical understanding, and I want to use the silver cup and handle is the perfect example, right? If you have no idea why that cup and handle exists, maybe you can trade on the cup and handle. But if you understand why the silver cup and handle exists, suddenly your argument is much more powerful. The silver cup and handle exists because the silver futures market has been pumping ungodly amounts of fake paper silver into that market, keeping the price suppressed, right? So, you know, the price dropped down and they kept it hovering at, you know, what, at 10 bucks or something for 20 years, and then it cupped up and then it dipped down, but they weren't able to suppress it as much the second time, and now it's cupping back up. That has a story behind why the cup and handle even exists. So when you understand that, you say, oh wow, I think they've been manipulating the silver markets. I should probably be in a silver position to take advantage of the cup and handle possibly, you know, the suppression breaking and the cup and handle going vertical. So the cup and handle to me of the silver market, that is confirmation of my logical underpinning. I would never just look at a cup and handle and say, oh, there is a cup and handle. Therefore, in the abstract ether, right? If I see a cup and handle, I know that I must invest heavily into whatever this is, right? If there was a cup and handle on sardines, and I had no idea why the cup and handle on sardines existed, should you rush out and buy, you know, sardines by the bucketful?
Because you probably think, not.
Right. There's going to be a shortage of sardines, right? You need to understand why this is happening.
Yeah. So when you're talking about money itself in a cup and handle and money, you would, this is something that Robert Wenzel of Economic Policy Journal, I consider him my guru, but he wasn't a chart guy. But he didn't totally discount technical analysis. He did see some value to it in the sense that some patterns do reflect human emotions, which don't change. So in the sense that history rhymes and you can see these patterns because humans behave basically the same as we have been behaving for tens of thousands of years, if not longer, then if you can recognize these evolutionary patterns in the way humans trade things, then you can get out in front of the curve and make some money. It just, but it's not that you see a magic shape and then you're like, oh, abracadabra, and then you make thousands of dollars. So
Yeah.
that's what's going to happen. But patterns can help, but they're a very minor part of what you need to look for.
So the question is, are these gurus outperforming the market? The way to test this would be to test the gurus' plays against normal plays. With someone who's not just someone who's trying to dip their toe in by themselves and maybe a random distribution and see how they perform. Because remember, a random distribution of the stock market will still do this because there is so much liquidity jumping into the stock market. So a broad distribution of stocks, you'll get 5-10% returns. So are the technical gurus beating 10%? I doubt they are on average. And especially if you take it risk into, they might be making more high risk bets. And if those pay off, of course they look like geniuses. And if they don't pay off, then they look stupid. But here's another thing, right? The gurus are charging, Johnny Bravo's case, he was charging the base entry level fee was $1,000 a year just to join their network, right? And then there was another one for $1,700 a year, and then you could pay for AI bots to help you trade at $2,500 a year, right? So if you assume he has I think he's got 200,000 subscribers or something like that. So assume he has 100 paying subscribers. He has like 200,000 YouTube subscribers who like to watch his videos. Assume he has the bare minimum of like 100 paid subscribers in his network. That's $100,000 a year. So he can take that $100,000 a year. Plus, he's got the YouTube ad revenue off of 200,000 viewers. Plus, he's got, any advertisers he's doing on the show, right? So he can take an enormous position on, he can put $30,000 into a few trades, get the 10% return. Because that there was so much money staked, it looks like that was a very big dollar return, even if it was a safe bet. Let's say it was a 5% return with very little risk on the downside. Okay, but if you put in $30,000, now you've made what's 5%? $2,000, about $1,500, something like that. Okay, so you made $1,500 in a, maybe in a week or something like that off of a trade like that. You look pretty smart. That does look pretty smart. But the problem is, a normal person cannot show up with $30,000 to stake. They're going to show up with $800 to stake. So they come back with, what's 5% of $800? $20. $20 after
8 times
2 weeks.
5 is 40, $40.
$40. Okay, so they show up with $40 after the same time period. Yeah, I mean, look, it's great to have $40. That's not life-changing money. That's not life. So the guru, I think what the gurus are doing is they're showing up with heft. They're showing with big bank accounts, making steady profits, making a small profit, pulling in the big bucks because they brought so much weight into it. And then their trading subscribers like to follow along. Yeah, they win a bit here and there. Yeah, they absolutely probably win a bit here and there. I don't think they can quit their you can't quit their day job in technical trade because they're not going to be making enough. You have to
So
have
what you're saying,
gurus
is
have
that
income.
they're, sorry, they're just small time basis traders, because when you get down to the biggest of these humongous trades, it's basically basis trading. That's where the $3.5 trillion are being traded back and forth in the repo markets. They're being used to sell Treasury futures forward, and then buy the and then buy the paper, and then profit off the spread, hundreds of times over the same trade over and over and over again, because it's as close to a guaranteed penny as you can get. And as long as you can keep multiplying it, then keep doing that. And then the question is, well, if they have that much money, why don't they do some of the guru stuff? Well, because then they're going to disturb the system. And that's like, if you go back in time, and even I remember you used the Back to the Future 2 analogy, right? Going back in
Oh,
time
yeah, Biff, yeah.
and betting on the sports games. But the problem is, I think this is related, but I'm not sure, that if you go back in time and start betting on those games, you're going to get attention very quickly, and that itself is going to change the fabric of space time, and the butterfly effect's going to screw everything up. It's not going to work anyway. So
Yeah.
what you'd have to do is you'd have to make the bets very quietly, so that almost nobody that that's so that nobody notices, because the minute you tell somebody, the rumor is going to spread, and then the game's over.
Yeah. That's the other thing. Like, if the technical analysis worked, it would be the most closely guarded secret on earth. Like, if you could reliably beat the stock market with every single trade you made, or, you know, even not every single trade, but if you could reliably beat the stock market 60% of the time, 70% of the time, yeah. I mean, that's an enormous, enormous valuable tool that would be very highly protected.
You had people that did that. Yeah, you have some people that actually did that, like Jim Rogers and George Soros when they worked together. That's one of the mysteries of finance, that Jim Rogers and George Soros actually worked together. I can't think of two opposite people, but wow. I think they had the quantum fund and it went up like 10,000% in just like 10 years or something. And then Jim Rogers retired at like 35 and he spent the rest of his time writing books and traveling the world and just like being a fun guy in Singapore hanging out. And George Soros went into the career of like screwing everything up and making everyone's life a living hell and causing a whole bunch of anti-Semitism and making me really nervous.
Yeah. There absolutely are, and that's a great point. If you discover a secret sauce, you keep it freaking secret. You don't sell it for $1,000 subscription.
Yeah.
If there is some, and that's how Warren Buffett discovered a big market inefficiency, and he jumped on it, as did Michael Burry. These things do exist, but once again, you don't go telling everybody. You know.
So just to cap this topic off. What we're doing is slightly different. It's basically the same thing, but you could say it's a little bit different because we're betting on gold and silver and gold mining stocks and gold streamers or whatever we have all our portfolio and this and that. But more than just saying like our stocks are going to go up faster than the market, which I think is true. It hasn't panned out yet. But really what we're saying is that when the liquidity dries up and everything crashes – and the dollar no longer works, these stocks are still going to have a lot of value, whereas all the other ones won't, right? So whatever happens at the end, whether our stocks go up in dollar value is not really the point. I don't even think that's what's going to happen. I think everything is just going to fall, and then the mining stocks will still have fundamental value, and therefore all the purchasing power, no matter what the dollar number is, will flood into our assets.
My advice is also, it's freely given and it's very simple, which is just stack gold and silver. Like I'm not selling a course on how to stack gold and silver. It's very easy. You go to the store, you buy some gold and silver, you hide it somewhere. And that's really
what we're selling is how to be confident in doing that no matter what the number says at any given time.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. A little bit of wisdom there, but
yeah, we're holding people's hands and saying, it's okay. You can do this. Don't worry.
Right. And also at least I'm advising not to participate in the I think the technical trade is going to, like, how are the technical traders going to see a pan sell off, right? Like a 1929 or 1987, you know, the market goes down 60% a day, right? Is the cup and handle going to help you predict that? I don't think so.
No, that goes to Taleb, Nicholas Nassim Taleb's books, right? What does he call it? The Black Swan and all that other stuff. So
yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. And you're not going to be, you know, if a demand destroying event like that occurs, like, you're goodbye, you know, you lost everything on the market, and you're not going to get it back certainly in time for the rest of the end game. Because once they turn on the printers, when they turn the printers back on after a crash like that, that money, that new liquidity is probably going to go into, if we're right, it's going to go straight into consumer goods. People are going to abandon the markets and go straight into hoarding whatever they can. So you lost your seed capital in the crash because it wasn't real, because it was fake. So that was the money you should have used to buy gold and silver, or that was the dollars you should have used to buy gold and silver. That's gone, and now you're going into the end game without what you thought you had.
Yeah, you just look at any hyperinflationary country going on right now. You can look at Turkey. Look at Turkey's Turkey's stock market versus their consumer prices. I mean, the market cap of all Turkish stocks is way, way down over the last 2 or 3 years when the hyperinflation really got off. But let's go to the next topic, Phil. What is how is the government going to mint silver coins? Or hopefully it won't be the government. How is silver going to be minted again in endgame times?
Sure. So I get this question a lot from my viewers, which is, if the government hasn't, you know, the government makes a token amount of silver eagles, but that's not like currency they're not printing enough for currency. They're printing enough for like collectors to get, you know, give out at birthdays and, you know, stackers to stack, but it's not enough to like run an economy off of. And they haven't done that since 1971, right? So the question is, how are we supposed to get new silver coins into the economy if the government hasn't made silver in a long time and has, you know, there's probably, I don't think they have giant vaults of silver anywhere to make, to turn into coinage. So the short answer is they don't have to. Money is the commodity itself. There is zero requirement that the government stamp is what makes the money the useful currency. The private market could absolutely make silver coins. And what would that look like? So initially, it'd be pretty chaotic. You know, Scottsdale Mint would probably make a coin this big, and Asahi Mint would make a coin this big, and, you know, another mint would make something this big, and they'd all be called, you know, the dollar, the Asahi dollar and the Scottsdale dollar. And of course, it'd be really hard to price because there's all these people, and you know, they'd have the dime and the quarter, and the, you know, they'd have sub denominations as well. It'd be really hard to price out because all these companies are making different things. So the market would quickly determine a standard. It'd be like a USB port, right? Mm-hmm. There's a bazillion companies that make things that plug into the USB port, but all computers have the same USB port. It's, you know, and there's different companies that make
the gas tank or the electric charger, yeah. Whatever. It always homogenizes to one or two things. Even yeah. like what was it, the beginning of VHS versus VTR, or the two cassettes, only the one of them survived, or 8 tracks didn't survive, but cassette tapes did. There's always one and not the other.
Yeah.
Blu-ray beat out DVD. It's going to happen with money too.
Yeah. Yeah, very quickly a standard will emerge. It may look nothing like what we had before. I'm not saying constitutional silver was the ideal system for setting up a silver standard. I have no idea. I'm just one man. I could not possibly seek to figure out what the market is going to come up with, what the free market would come up with a silver standard. Mm-hmm. And people would just trade off that. And we have the added benefit here. The purity would be pretty much guaranteed by the other mints, because if Scottsdale Mint tried to skimp on the purity, say, oh, let's make it 75% instead of 90%, well, the Asahi Mint would constantly be checking Scottsdale Mint's coins, and the second they had a low purity mint, the Asahi Mint would put out a full page advertisement all over, advertising blitz everywhere: Scottsdale Mint's cheating on their purity, use Asahi 90% pure silver, right? They could put ads out, they could shame Scottsdale Mint into producing back up to 90%. So that competition between the mints would keep the currency honest. Now, unfortunately, this is pie in the sky libertarian nonsense. None of this is going to happen because the first thing governments always do is take command of the currency. So we can hope this won't happen, or this will happen, but it's probably going to be the government's going to start doing things to get its hands on silver so they can print official government currency again, because once again, the free market cannot be trusted because of, you know, speculator or whatever.
Well, so let me challenge you there. You often say that in the end game, the government's going to have to shrink by 99% or more in order to stay alive. So if the government's shrinking by 99% or more, then the 1% that's left is going to have to focus on minting a money, because otherwise they'll lose everything.
Yeah.
That's what you think is going to happen.
Yeah, yeah, I think in the initial aftermath of the crash, we will be using whatever silver's on hand. So silver forks, private rounds, melted down tea sets. It's all good. Like it'll all be good. You know.
Yeah, I believe that too. I believe that intellectually, but I have a hard time actually believing it. Still,
I know what you mean.
I can't picture people walking around with coins and giving them to each other for food and water. And because I know that when we do come down to that situation, the amount of desperation in the streets everywhere is going to be so extreme that I have other things to worry about. I'm already seeing desperation in the streets where I live, yeah. And the streets aren't that bad here. But I see people's situations and the debt that they're in, and the fact that they just don't care anymore, because why should they care? Because it's just impossible. I mean, Israel's just as inflationary as the U.S., if not worse. But we're going to be walking around with pouches of silver. That's what's going to happen.
Jingling pouches, dollar signs, $3 signs printed on the pouch. Yeah,
yeah.
That'll be rich. So what I would say is, like, you don't have to save everybody. You just have to save the neighbors, and then they'll have money, and they can save their neighbors. Like it's going to, you know, spread out in pulses.
Yeah.
So You don't have to have enough silver to save the state of Israel.
Yeah, well, the good part is that all the debt that people are in is going to be erased also.
Yes.
And, you know, everyone in debt is paying everyone else who's in debt. And the rich people just manage their debt better than the poor. Nobody has any savings. Even if they have savings in shekels, they don't have any savings in actual things. They have savings in nobody has any gold. There are no stackers in this country. None. There's not zero. There's some, but there's no there's no culture of stacking. It means that everybody has only the stuff that they have, only the assets that they have, which are massively overvalued in shekel terms. And then they lose all of that, and then they have to sell it because they have to default on their debt. So they have to sell for even lower so that the value of this stuff goes even more and more down in terms of real money. It's gonna be a very cathartic disaster.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah. But anyway, the remnant of the government, whatever's left of the government, is probably going to start minting coins right away. And so how are they going to get their hands on silver to do that? There's a variety of methods available to the government. Some are more benevolent than others. The first one is to just start selling. At least in the U.S., there's enormous amounts of federal land, federal assets that a government that shrinks by 99% simply will not be able to manage. So they'll sell all their office buildings in D.C. They'll sell all their the state parks and the national the state parks too, probably sold by the local governments, the national parks, national forests. They'll sell military assets. And, you know, people think I'm a little crazy. When the USSR fell, you could buy a submarine. Like, you could literally buy an attack sub. Like,
what about nuclear weapons?
You, Rafi Farber, I don't know. I mean, there certainly was the worry of that. I mean, there was the worry that, like, someone was going to buy missiles, nuclear missiles. And so the Western governments were trying to, like, get their hands on the Kazakh, you know, the Kazakh missiles and things like that, because they were worried the USSR was going, you know, that Russia and these, you know, the post-Soviet states were going to completely collapse.
Yeah, but this time there's no babysitter. Back when the USSR fell, the US was still in charge to babysit the nuclear weapons and make sure that they didn't get out of the playpen. This time there's not going to be a babysitter.
I mean, hopefully they get decommissioned before they get, before they get launched. I think there's process. I mean, I don't know, but I think
there's
processing.
Yeah, but then again, think about this. That the people that decommission them are probably all on Ritalin or some kind of meth to keep them concentrating, but there's not going to be enough methamphetamines to go around to decommission these missiles, and they're all going to be ADHD nuclear missile decommissioners. That's comforting.
That's comforting.
I have a meme for that.
Get off the nuclear warhead.
Okay. I mean, we'll see. You know, like I the way I get through this is just to say, I'm just one man, focus on your local environment. I can't, if I sit there just fretting about the nuclear missiles and the post in game, I'm like, it's a thing I have no control over, so I might as well not worry about it.
Yeah, I just looked to my faith in God. I was like, I can't, like, this is your planet, God. I'm not dealing with this. This is, just leave me alone.
You know what I wish someone had done when the USSR fell was bought Lenin's corpse and, like, flown it to Las Vegas and just, like, put it in a casino. Like, it would have just been the most, like, richest irony. Like, you probably could have bought, if someone had wanted to, I bet you could have gotten Lenin's corpse. It might have cost a pretty penny, but you probably could have gotten Lenin's corpse.
Okay, well, so what corpses do you want to buy in the endgame?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Start thinking about
what corpses do we want to buy for?
We could probably buy Lenin's corpse after the end game this time.
And Russia might hyperinflate again. Yeah, it might be. But anyway, the point I was making before we went off this tangent was not to go crazy. Like, if Old Faithful or one of the faces on Mount Rushmore is for sale, don't buy it, because the government will reform at some point, and they're just going to renationalize that stuff at some point. You know, they will get their shit together at some point, and they're going to renationalize all that stuff again. And, you know, if you have an F-35 in your driveway just because you bought it during the collapse, they're going to confiscate that, and they're probably going to throw you in jail for being an insurrectionist or something. So the point was to, you know, don't go overboard. I know. And I spoke about this with Dunnigan on LNF, which hasn't posted yet. But I said, you know, there's a lot of libertarians who, you know, think, well, the Constitution says that I can have whatever weapons I want, and I'm interpreting that to mean I can have an F-35. You know, logically,
That's not going to hold.
I agree with you philosophically, but it's not going to hold. Right. Exactly right. It's simply not going to hold. You're not going to win that battle. So don't even try it. But there are things you can buy. You can buy a national forest and put your house in the middle of it, and then they'll say, "Well, it's not a national forest anymore because there's a couple houses here." You know, we can't. You know, the land's been sold. So there are things you can do from the public land, and they will sell this. They're going to sell all these assets just for gold and silver. It's going to be, give us your gold, give us your silver. We will sell these lands. That is one way they can get a bunch of gold and silver real quick, is to sell all their assets.
Right.
Another way is to just, what was the other way? They can, oh, seigniorage. Seigniorage was the other way. They say, okay, we, the government, have this new plate of silver stuff we're going to mint. Here's the new silver dollar. Here's the new silver quarter. Here's the new silver dime. Here's the new nickel and the penny, right? And these may look nothing like constitution. Once again, there's no requirement that we go back to constitutional. In fact, if I was the government, I would make a new one. So you have to hand in all your old silver, and then we will mint it into the new coinage. And the new coinage will be, so you give us 100 ounces of raw silver, we give you back 98 ounces minted constitutional silver. So that 2% is the seigniorage. That's the tax the government uses to fund all the government operations. And of course, everyone goes and hands in all their silver because they want to do official coinage. And the government can make a lot of money that way too. And they can get more importantly, they can get the coins out into the population through the process of seigniorage. So those are the two most benevolent ways the government can get their hands on silver. There's less benevolent ways. They can seize the COMEX if the COMEX might have a bunch of silver locked in there, and other large private vaults. I doubt they'll go after the small private vaults, just because once they grab the large ones, people are probably going to start panicking and start taking their gold and silver out of the small private vaults. So they may not get to the small vaults in time. So they'll probably grab the COMEX. If they go through with this, they'll grab the COMEX. Are there any other large vaults in the U.S.? A couple other big ones.
Denver and Fort Knox.
Denver. Okay. Canada will probably – now, I do want to warn people, if governments could grab you, Canada will probably grab the Sprott vaults, which are the P-Silv and Fizz.
Yeah. Canada's already turned totalitarian, basically.
Yeah. I don't think P-Silv and Fizz are going to get you through the end game. Just words of advice, words of friendly non-advice, because we can't give advice. That's illegal. Yeah. So they can seize vaults. They can tax mines. They can say, or just nationalize the mines outright. So they'll say, all right, silver mines, you're on U.S. land and this land belongs to the people and we are representatives of the people. So you owe us 10, 20, 30, 40% of whatever comes out of the ground. And of course, that affects the mining stocks. So people that thought your mining stocks were going to generate a certain amount of revenue, they're going to generate a lot less if the government starts taxing the stuff coming out of the ground. Hopefully it's not too much of a tax. You know, if it's 10%, you can live with that. If they nationalize the mines outright, then the mining stock guys get left holding bags. Those are bag holders. Anything else they can do to get their hands on silver real quick?
Look, hopefully they won't. We don't want them to get their hands on the silver. I'd much rather the free market negotiate this, even if it takes them a little bit longer. How long did it take for the USB to be standardized? Not very long at all. You go through a little bit. It's the payoff for going through a little bit of market turbulence in terms of standardization is
much better,
definitely
honestly.
Worth it than giving the government carte blanche to start minting money again and then start the inflationary process over from a running start.
I'm not saying it's good. I'm just saying these are the things tyrannical governments do when they want to get their grubby hands on people's gold and silver.
Right.
And they could try and tax the gold and silver directly. So they could say, Italy's trying to do this right now. They're like, let us know how much gold you have so we can determine a tax rate for you. I'm sure that's working real well.
Yeah.
I'm sure people are lining up with all their gold piles to let the government know how much they have. Yeah. But anyway, that's pretty much it. Hopefully, I'm totally with you, Rafia. Hopefully the free market determines the currency and the government never gets involved again. You know, if history is a guide, I'm skeptical on that one. But, you know, there's liberty is a spectrum.
Sorry, now that we're talking about the government politicizing money, there was a development this weekend that seems kind of innocuous and stupid. That one day old the ACIP, the Committee on Vaccine Recommendations or something, the fact that we even have one of those is dumb. The chiddush that they made, or the new the new guideline is that parents and their care and their caregivers and you know, like pediatricians, should decide between themselves if they're going to give their babies a hepatitis B vaccine shot, right? What, like, that's so revolutionary. Like, let doctors decide with parents if they are going to give this shot or not.
But then what's the point of ACIP? They were there. They were there to make the decision for us.
Look, once you to pull this back to money eventually. That was people who listen to this show know that I listen to Brett Weinstein a lot because he has such potential to understand the whole monetary shell game, but he just doesn't quite get it. And he was saying there's no reason for this to be a political issue, right? Whether to give one-day-old babies a hepatitis B shot, and the only way you can get hepatitis B is by having unprotected sex with a very experienced prostitute or intravenous drug use with dirty needles, neither of which babies are going to do. And this was specifically for babies that whose mothers test negative for hepatitis B. Now, I have to admit that all of my kids have the hepatitis B vaccine and they all got it on their first day of life. I didn't know anything back then. I just thought that this is what protects them, and there's so little downside to the vaccine that if I don't do it and then later in life they end up getting hepatitis B for whatever reason, the guilt will be on me. So I was like, why even confront this? But then when you get into the actual data and you see that this is not safe, then the whole idea of giving these shots to day-old babies is completely nuts. And when you realize why they're doing it, why are they doing it? Because even though there's zero chance that a baby will come down with hepatitis B, if you put this shot in the childhood schedule, which automatically grants these companies liability exemption, right? It has to be on the childhood schedule for them not to have liability for any negative effects caused by these shots. So once you give it to babies, even though babies don't need it, then even adults can't sue for any harms that are caused by the hepatitis B vaccine. So now you know why it's in there. And now you know why these companies are fighting so hard to make sure that day-old babies get the vaccine, right? That's why. It has nothing to do with the baby. It has to do with them not wanting to pay for any lawsuits for any negative effects that these vaccines might have. That's what it's about. And then he made this comment, and this is where it comes to money, that this should not be a political issue, okay? Yeah, that's right. It shouldn't be what is a political issue? A political issue is an issue where the government decides what's going to be. That's a political issue. So anything that has to do with public works or taxes or collect or the public purse is going to be a political issue. Now, the more stuff you put into the government, the more authority you give them, the more things get political. So the quintessential example that I give from the maximum amount of politics was breathing, right? In 2020 and 2021, breathing became a political issue. Everyone had to wear a mask. I couldn't breathe when wearing a mask. I don't think it was a physical issue, like, because when a mask was on my face, it was like, they're trying to shut me up. I can't wear this thing. I'm hyperventilating whenever it's on my face. I can't live like this. So I would not put it on. And so breathing became politics. But if you want to get things out of the government, if you want the government to be small and for things not to be a political issue, for parents and doctors to decide for themselves if they want their day-old babies to have a shot that will prevent them from a sexually transmitted disease that they're almost certainly never going to get, if you want to make that decision yourself and not be in politics, then what you need to do is get government out of money. Once the government is not involved in money, then money itself becomes private, and then the government can steal it through taxes, through direct taxes of whatever, but they can't do it through inflation, which people don't recognize as a tax, right? And once you have private money, then everything else falls off because it can't be funded by the inflation tax. And then everything starts to be private again. You can make these decisions yourself. That's what we want. The only public issues should be basically, how big do we want the army? Do we want to invade this country or not? And negotiating treaties with other countries that the public should really not be involved in, right? Those kinds of things. But beyond minarchistic considerations, courts, war, and what is it? Basically, minarchy is defense in courts, right? There's nothing else. So beyond that, nothing should be political at all.
I agree.
And the only way to do that is to get them out of the money. You don't have, like, we have to stop looking at the side issues, right? Health is a side issue. Education is a side issue. Why? Because it's all funded by the money, which is inflationary. That's the message that you and I focus on. If we take the government out of money, they, by extension, they have to get out of almost everything else.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. I mean, like I said, I think this is going to shrink the government by about 99%. So I think they will be out of our lives for generations, for the most part.
And the positive message I want to close this with is, it seems like a very minor victory for the MAHA movement, for Make America Healthy Again. This is probably the lowest hanging fruit, the absolute lowest hanging fruit, giving one-day-old babies hepatitis B vaccines. It sounds nuts. But you know, I was nuts too, because I gave all my kids that. I didn't know anything. But what if we have this tiny little victory, then we'll start to see how brittle everything else is, which is why they're fighting us. If they give any ground, then people start digging more and they see what other holes there are, and they'll attack those next. You'll see. Like, it seems like a very small victory, but it's a very big one. We'll see what happens next.
Amen, Rafi.
All right. I'm with you. Okay. Good.
Yeah, no, I don't think I have anything else in particularly intelligent to add to that. That was very well done.
So. Okay, good. So shut up.
Yeah, I will.
Okay. All right. Thanks everyone for joining us on this, whatever day it is that I put this up, probably tomorrow. And we'll see you guys next month. And maybe the end game will happen by then. Could be.
Then we won't see you next month.
Yeah, we'll see you after the silver starts circulating.
All right. See you, Rafi.
Okay, bye.